What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Managing Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Also joining us this week is Podcast Producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
God damn it. Hello. Hi, everybody.
That's all you need. That's all you need, Ben. That's all you need, because we've got a lot of stuff to dive into. This is actually a pretty jam-packed episode of news. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop an email at podcastengadget.com, and you can join us Thursday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern, typically, on our live stream, on our YouTube channel, so you can see our faces. Sometimes we show off gadgets, and we're always talking to the chat. We're actually having a really great conversation this week leading into all these topics, so join us. But the main thing is the very stupid thing that has kind of taken over the week. It's Signalgate, Signalgazi, whatever you want to call it. The whole situation of Atlantic editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg getting inadvertently invited to a Signal war plan chat, I guess, between Pete Hegseth and other folks in the Trump administration. That is the broad story, you know? So basically he was invited to this thing. I think he announced himself towards the end that, hey, I'm here, and he left rather than sit and like gather information or keep it for a book. So I've had a lot of issues with The Atlantic in terms of how it's covered things lately and kind of its weird spin sometimes on things. But hey, this is getting the story out there, making this public. And also after the Trump administration basically started denigrating Jeffrey Goldberg, he and The Atlantic went through the process of saying, like, should we just release all these texts? Because they say it's not classified. Everybody in the administration say it's not a problem. He went through the steps to get that out there, too. So that's a whole story. I just have to say, as this thing was rolling out, I could not stop shaking my head, because I kind of feel like, I've been saying this for a while, it feels like we live in a Paul Verhoeven movie that's also kind of crossed with Idiocracy at times, and this is like the clearest example of this. This is a plot line that would seem too ludicrous for something like Veep. Sherlyn, what did you think upon hearing the details of this story?
For me, the first I saw of this story was on social media, and kudos to The Atlantic for this headline, but it was like, the Trump administration accidentally texted me its war plans. And
that's a good headline.
It's a really good headline. You're immediately, instantly grabbed into the story. We're like, wait, what? Like, chalk this up to another, like, you're like, immediately like, wait, what happened? And is it as bad as I think it is? And then you read into the story. And I don't know about you, Devendra. I had my skepticism, right? Like, I was like, I know The Atlantic is a reputable publication. I know that as a journalist, we have to be able to back up our stuff before coming out with a claim like this. So I knew in my gut it was true. However, I have a lot of these opposing voices in my head where I know there's going to be people that are like, it's fake, back it up. And they're already decided that they're not going to believe the story no matter what. So they're probably telling themselves, you know, themselves in their head, like, oh, they probably can fake some evidence or whatever. As the story continued to unfold, it is, you know, we find out later the same day the story goes up on The Atlantic that there's a Senate hearing, the director of national intelligence is questioned, and it becomes clear this is not just some made up thing, that there exists such a chat, that what they were in the end arguing over is whether the level of information shared was classified a certain level or not, and or whether certain rules. So like, this did happen. And the fact that it did happen is really, really incredible and mind-blowing to me. Like, forget all the legalities of it. It was just hilarity and awe, you know?
Also, the lying hands not being able to talk to each other, because people in the Senate hearings were saying, yes, not classified information. Pete Hegseth on an airbase somewhere, like saying, no, there was no chat. This is all a lie. They can't keep the lie straight. That's something. I also want to be clear here, too. Specifically, these were plans for an attack by U.S. forces on Houthi rebels in Yemen. And it's kind of all related to the stories we've been hearing about Houthi pirates in the seas, right, and in the Suez Canal, basically interrupting shipping, interrupting international trade. You never want to do that. America does not like that. Other countries don't like that. So
you also have to remember that this is not just for fun and profit on their part. It is also like an ideological thing. These attacks ramped up after Israel clamped down on Gaza after October 7, 2023.
It's all related. Like, it's also, so a strike did happen. They had a target. They attacked the target. And I don't want to minimize this either as we talk about how stupid the actual chat scenario is and how this is all done. But according to, I believe, the Yemeni Health Service, which is Houthi run at this point, but they say 53 people were killed in this attack because it collapsed a building. They were after one target to collapse the building. Even if that number is inflated, it was a whole building. So definitely multiple people died. We don't know exactly how many. But
they were following this one guy to his girlfriend's place.
To his girlfriend's
building.
And
then they were like, you know
what?
Yeah. Collateral damage, whatever.
Yep. So that's the whole thing. And that mass killing, potentially, like with the ability to send a strike without worrying about civilian casualties, like that's potential war crime shit. And this was celebrated in the group chat with emojis and just like really, really like the typical group chat praise. It just felt really very much like we were living in a dystopia here. So that is the setup. That is what actually happened. The other thing we're talking about is how Jeffrey Goldberg and The Atlantic responded to it. In his piece, he says, you know, he also did not know how true it was. He didn't know if it was a setup or not, because journalists are often targeted with false information, people claiming other things, like just bad setups to really get you in a bad spot, especially for somebody like him who's leading The Atlantic. So,
yeah, the beginning of the first article, he was like, I didn't know whether or not this was real until bombs started falling 2 hours later. I heard some people online saying, oh, well, why didn't he come out with this like immediately? You know, he could have saved lives across the world. That's not really how this works. Like,
you can't run with everything you hear immediately.
Yeah. And while you're sitting on your couch trying to figure out whether or not you are being played by some kind of like, who is James O'Keefe related to? That's some kind of media gadfly organization.
Right. The guy who sets people up for like, yeah, he sets up.
Yeah, he's like a right-wing provocateur. And so as the editor of The Atlantic, you have no idea whether or not you are being set up by some very elaborate prank, basically.
It's also so dumb that you're like, it kind of has to be a prank, right? Like, this can't be real. They can't be doing this all over Signal. Let's talk quickly about what Signal is, because we've talked about Signal before. We've talked about group chat services, what's encrypted, what's secure. Signal is actually among the better ones. It's the one I tell like my friends to use if they want to have encrypted chats, if they want to kind of be really secure. As much as I like Signal, and even though I think it's a pretty great app and the open source organization behind it does a really good job of like really trying to promote free speech and secure communications, like working against what governments want them to do often, any tool can be used badly. And this feels like, as great as it is, you can't have like super classified conversations here. The other problem is that Jeffrey Goldberg was basically inadvertently invited and they did not even know. And this is a problem IT workers face. It doesn't matter how many layers of security you put on people and your employees, like the little babies you're trying to protect from hurting themselves, they're going to find a way
there will be human
to do
errors.
Something really stupid. Yep. There will be human errors. And this was ultimately a major, like this is not a Signal error. This is somebody invited this dude to the chat who shouldn't. That is a very human problem. Like often for Engadget, like when we go remotely, when we go for international trips and we like need to organize stuff, we're on other apps. We're on like, what is it? Not WhatsApp, but
Telegram.
We often use Telegram. These things are weird where sometimes it pulls in somebody's phone number that you may have, but somebody may have changed that phone number. So you end up like texting another user. And I've gotten really angry responses to like, get me out of this group chat or something. That is a common problem. This should not be even be a problem within, you know, government folks who are working with confidential data, with classified data, who are literally planning war strikes. We don't know who had access to this. It is a very plain way to like share the stuff badly, right, Trillin?
I would say that like if you think about it this way, the discourse around this has gone over this, but I just wanted to state it for our podcast because it touches on technology like that we cover, right? So we don't cover like apps that the government makes for its own in-house communication. Obviously, for obvious reasons, we don't have access, and rightly so. The reason, the distinction between a communication app that, say, the White House makes and uses versus Signal is that the White House hopefully it is, has IT people that are smart enough to be like, we are the ones that allow people who, you know, send you the link to download this and allow the users. We create your user profile. So the people
it's not
in there.
It's not just an app.
It's not just an app. There's skiffs. There's like other ways you communicate depending on the classification levels, like super high level stuff. You go into a place with like RFID blockage and you go inside and talk. You put your phones in the what's the name of the box? There's a box that blocks out all communication. I forget what's the, like, there's a term for it.
Right.
But anyway, you prevent like people from eavesdropping on you. You like a bug-free area. There's that sort of high level. And then there's apps that you can communicate. Like I've used certain apps like that before, not by the government, like in other organizations. And it's like, it's so rudimentarily made because they don't understand UI or they don't care about the UI. They care more about the security than anything else. Signal is an app for consumers. It's supposed to be easy to use in addition to being secure because they're targeting a much broader audience and they also access your phone's contactless. And also they have like a very easy way for people to add you as a friend or a user, right? For several reasons, including ease of use and like accessibility and wanting to broaden their user base, hopefully or understandably. And obviously their encryption has to be good, blah, 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 but that's not the point. They're utmost priority is not going to be your security versus the government's own app. So, I mean, I think that that's like, I wanted to go behind the scenes a little bit for people to like really understand this in real world terms, what that looks like, what these people had to do to flout those rules, you know?
Yeah. The real problem is that it's Mike Waltz, right? The national security advisor, but the person who added Jeffrey Goldberg to this chat did so by mistake and in a proper secure, highly classified data communication like platform, that would not be possible. Like there would be multiple layers of confirmation to get somebody in. The other downside to this, or the other controversy around this, is that a lot of people are pointing out that a lot of Signal's appeal is that not only are the chats encrypted, but you can also disappear
them. Right.
You can also like self-destruct them, Mission Impossible style. In fact, we see that turned on in the chat at one point.
Like, and no, actually at the very beginning of the chat, when Goldberg was invited to it, I'm looking at it right now. It says disappearing messages set to 1 week. That itself is a violation of many federal records acts.
Yeah, because you're supposed to, even if it's classified data, you need to keep a record of what's happening in case we ever need to go back to it. But go ahead, Sherlyn.
No, I mean, that's the same thing, right? Like, yeah, there's a need for FOIA records to be, like, kept and therefore, or records to be kept for, like, Freedom of Information Act requests in future and that sort of stuff, or just a general, like, lapsing of protection rules around these types of documentation. But, like, yeah, I mean, that's why I think the disappearing text thing was, like, funny at the start, but, like, it didn't immediately, like, strike me as like a rule break, right? Because I was like, I completely forgot about the documentation rule. So it's like, oh, I guess they wanted more privacy. But like, that's, yeah, to your point, right? Like, that's another reason people use these in-house apps because there's a paper trail that needs to be documented and followed. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, them just using really silly emojis to celebrate, you know, they basically planned the deaths of lots of innocent people, most likely. We don't have an official full number outside of the Yemeni government, but still. It's absolutely gross. There have been follow-up stories, too. The Pentagon has been warning government officials that Signal's being targeted by Russian hackers. That is a thing that's kind of been ongoing. There was a Wired story around this, too, because NPR kind of falsely reported early warnings about Signal. So, and then there have been some back and forth from the people at Signal, like Meredith Whitaker, I think the president of Signal. The whole thing with Signal is that they're saying they don't have an actual vulnerability. What was happening is that Russian hackers were targeting people in Ukraine with the QR code that you typically send to somebody to add them to a chat, right? Except they were sort of like twisting the QR code a bit so that it was also the same QR code that you could use to link your chat to another computer, which is one of those nice things that Signal and WhatsApp and pretty much every major like platform has now so that you don't have to type in your password everywhere. It's a secure way to link devices, except if somebody... Yeah, if somebody sends you that picture, it's very easy to just like, oh, I need to add to this chat. You don't know if that you're actually linking another device. So Signal said that they were looking into this before. They've added alerts so that should have been there before. But they've added alerts so that, hey, by the way, this device, your chat is now linked to another device. So that is a new thing here. But the Signal like algorithm, their encryption layer, their security mechanism, that has not been cracked. So that I just want to make that absolutely
it's
clear.
It's still a decent app. It's just because it's got caught up in this gaffe and it's being targeted doesn't necessarily mean it's insecure or, you know, exploited or exploitable. I haven't, like, I don't think we
it's
can
all
say
all the way you use it.
Exactly. And to your...
You could have the most secure app in the world right. And if you invite
But Devendra, you are a former, like, IT administrator or at least have experience in that place. Like, how do you feel about all of this? Like, what would you have done if you were an IT admin in the White House?
This is why you tell people not to use, like, if you are, there are multiple levels of data. So I used to work at a college and some departments are dealing with student health data, which is a different level of classification of sensitivity. So you need to treat that specially. And certainly at the government level, if you are planning a freaking war strike, that's like the highest of the high. There's a lot of things you wouldn't want to use. IT departments often restrict like what apps people can use for actual corporate work, for their work within their environments. A lot of companies may allow Signal, you know, but they may also have other platforms they prefer. People tend to go off book, essentially, and use right. the things that they're most familiar with. And I think like that's just what happened at Signal. This affects everybody. Like the whole controversy around Hillary Clinton's email server, which seems more than a little overblown now. But that was the whole thing about her interacting with government email on a personal email server. So not necessarily as secure. She wanted the convenience of like having all her email together on her phone. But that's also something I've dealt with, like professors who forwarded, you know, their like more sensitive work email to their personal Gmail or something. And I'm like, you can't always do that. You know, they're not dealing with highly sensitive data, but still like it's not. It kind of introduces certain problems within the IT infrastructure. Anyway, go ahead.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Most major tech companies probably also have SCIFs, especially if they deal in government contracts. And they would not violate any of the like chain of custody rules when it comes to documents or anything, lest they lose those extremely valuable government contracts. Here we have like the actual principles, you know, the it's called a PC small group, but the PC is for principal committee. It's not for personal computer. Talking about like airstrikes on their personal cell phones outside of hardened points.
Yeah.
One of the people on the small group chat was confirmed to be in Moscow at the time. Meanwhile, they're texting emojis as if they're trying to organize a weekend trip.
Very sad. Like, there's a meme. There's a meme going out like on TikTok, like, oh, the group chat leaked. Shut it down. Hide your shit because your girlfriend is seeing what you're saying on the group chat with your boys.
Do you guys ever get that feeling of like intense dread and I effed up because like you accidentally sent the wrong screenshot to the wrong group chat? Yeah, can you imagine like
you sent the wrong screenshot, the wrong message?
Can you imagine them not having that feeling and or having that feeling? Like I'm just like, what is in your brains right now? Because it's so and to the point of screenshots too, I in like talking with our team about how to cover this, I wondered if we needed to answer the question of, can you screenshot these messages? This was before the screenshots actually came out. I was wondering if, like, you know, can they be easily forged? Can they be, I mean, anything can be forged with enough Photoshop skills. But I was like, does Signal alert you the way Snap does when someone takes a screenshot? No, it doesn't. Should it build in that feature? I don't know if it needs to. It could. It should, maybe.
If you're worried about encrypted communications, and we've had that, Snapchat has had that feature forever, for a long, long time. Like you can,
and I think I think of there's a few other apps that do that. But anyway, I mean, can you imagine just the dread of seeing like you just had this group chat where you're like meme reacting to deaths, right? And then somewhere the app tells you Jeffrey Goldberg took a screenshot. Like I just would love to be in that room, just the heart rates, all the cardiologists that are on call just rushing to like, I don't know, Capitol Hill or something.
They had no clue for days. They had no clue that this was happening. So that's the whole thing. Also, the screenshot alert does not prevent somebody just taking a camera and pointing at your phone. So that's not a hardened, you know, thing either.
Yeah. I'm assuming that this was Goldberg's like maybe work phone. So he could have just used his personal phone to like take actual pictures of it.
I was going to say, Simon says, and I've done this before. Like I will use a second. I have so many phones. I use different phones to take photos of different things to avoid the screenshot trigger. But you know.
use your webcam, use whatever else. I want to wrap this up quickly because we got a bunch of stories to get into.
Yeah, Mark Dell in the chat says, was the person in Moscow a stranger? No, it was Trump's envoy to Ukraine in the Middle East, a guy named Steve Witkoff. But that does open up a good question of, man, who else could have been on here?
Anybody could have been on there.
Jamel Bowie at the New York Times basically said, like, you should just assume by now that every competent intelligence service across the world has a, like, live, real-time understanding of what's going on in the White House. If this is what they do, then how are they not, like, actively texting things to other people? How are some of these guys, especially Hegseth, not getting caught in, like, honeypot schemes or anything? Like, there's just so much stuff that could leak.
So many things, and specifically the Russian government and also, like, the Chinese government, which Trump has a lot of economic ties to as well. So, you know, just a messy state of affairs we're in. I think what we learned, folks, is be really careful about who you add to your group chats. Double check those contacts. Make sure that the phone number is alive.
And
don't take initials. Like, don't just add somebody by their initials.
If you need help, we have a very handy, very useful guide on Engadget.com how to add someone to your Signal group chat. So, you know.
That is a good, helpful piece. There are so many ways we could have run with that whole thing, too. Let's move on to some other news and kind of big news this week. 23andMe has filed for bankruptcy. CEO Ann Wojcicki, I don't know how you pronounce her name, actually, has stepped down. She is planning to independently bid for the genetic testing company, like for all that stuff. This is exactly what people were warning about when 23andMe launched and when I think there are other DNA collection companies. Like, it was a really interesting
Ancestry.com.
Ancestry.com. Yeah, yeah. But it was an interesting pitch. But then people started to worry, like, what are they going to do with this? Once they get you this little tidbit, you send them your saliva, they have your DNA on record, they can link you to other people, other users, they can link you to things happening in the past. What happens to that data? Somebody else buys this company, essentially that data goes to that buyer. Anything could happen. You know, so I feel like these are my worries basically coming to pass. I'm glad I never did this thing. Sherlyn, do you have any feels
around
this?
I think we talked on the podcast about me wanting to test my DNA for, like, actual helpful things,
yeah,
like, you know, breast cancer markers or, like, other types of hereditary diseases possibly. And I was like, cool, but always had my reservations, and I feel vaguely validated, even though I think it's not great. Like, I didn't want to be validated, right? Like, there's millions of people that use this service. A lot of joy and reunions have come out of it, but this is just sad, right? Like,
also, they found at least one serial killer through all of this stuff.
Well, there and serial rapist, lots of those. So, like, it's kind of, it's bittersweet. It's not bittersweet. I don't think there's any sweet. I'm conflicted, right? Like, it's just, how do I am not surprised. I am disappointed and validated. It's just mixed. I'm always mixed feelings about everything, I think.
It's like one of those complicated topics that I think of it like maybe the Minority Report problem a little bit too, right?
Right.
Like, the whole pitch of that was like, oh yeah, we could stop all crime, right? But it involves these psychics who have to go look into the future, and then you're arresting people ahead of time. Then you're working with all this data that you don't know about. And at the end of that movie, spoilers for Minority Report, you know, the program is shut down. The movie doesn't really get into this, but, you know, now murders can happen more freely. We don't talk about that at the end of Minority Report. Yeah.
I want to point out that people even in our chat are saying they've used it. And, like, there's stuff like Deep Ronayan saying their little sister found her father via the service a few years back. Like, it has had practical, I guess, you know, productive slash supposedly, hopefully, heartwarming results.
People have also found out that their local fertility doctor is actually their dad. And
that's the documentary on Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah. All the Netflix documentaries, like The Man with 1,000 Kids and all of that stuff, that can only be possible via these genetic testing services.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like this invention was inevitable, but our ability to, like, actually be safe with this data, we still don't know. So there is a statement from, who is it? Mark Jensen, who is a part of the board of directors, the special committee trying to sell the company. He's saying They're, quote, being transparent about the management of user data going forward, and data privacy will be an important consideration in any potential transaction, end quote. That can mean anything. That is wonderful legal cover your butt speak, but it could mean all sorts of stuff depending on who the who the actual buyer is. I want to point out we have a really good guide by Anna Washenko, how to delete your 23andMe data for anyone who did this and you want to like make sure that data. I don't know. We don't know. You don't know if like you click this button
exactly.
And they actually get rid of your data. We don't know how quickly that happens or what archives.
Or have they thrown away the actual sample? Really.
I mean, that I think that degrades over time.
Depends
right?
on how they store it, but yeah. I'm sure but it degrades over time.
The data might still be an issue. But I'm just thinking, like, if we perhaps had an FTC that actually worked, this would be something that they'd be talking about a lot, because there should probably be some federal regulations on whether or not someone's genetic data is private to them.
For sure. For
just
sure.
Just thinking out loud there.
Actual consumer protections, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is also, like, what can they do? Like, what can they do with that data? And yeah, it's what you're saying with the Minority Report stuff, but also, like, it is still your data, you know? It's still about you, so.
It's your data, but it's also, like, I can imagine if some, like, ad tech company were like, here, ooh, we got this pile of user data, which we can tie to individual identities. We have their browsing habits over here. We've got an AI soup
DNA,
over here
right.
that can give us, like, you got DNA, you can do ultra, like, can you create specifically targeted, targeted ads for people with specific DNA traits?
Right, right.
Something?
They're realizing that a certain DNA trait equals more susceptibility to certain styles of targeting. Maybe.
The people who are really prone to gambling, right. That is, that, yeah.
That episode
that's
on
an
sports
addiction
betting
marker.
On John Oliver last week tonight. Anyway, jeez.
Basically, like for some people can gamble and walk away and some people can't. And it's sort of like the people who can't stop drinking when they stop or when they start or something too. Like a lot of that is tied to our genetic responses to things. I don't know. We will
another
have,
thing to be yeah. a little afraid of is all of the data that like is just on 23andMe's servers, but we don't really know what to do with right now. You know, in 5 or 10 years, if they come up with some, you know, way to figure out, I don't know, is there a gay gene or something? That stuff is on 23andMe's servers now. It's just people didn't know whether or not, you know,
oh God.
That string of CTs, Gs, and As coded for that specific thing.
The evolutionary biologists can have a field day with this. Let's get to a gadget. Let's go to a real gadget. Sherlyn, you want to talk about the new Canons, the PowerShot V1 and R50V. Vlogging cameras. Or at least one vlogging camera and one like cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So this is Canon and this is, I believe, under the PowerShot brand. So this is the V1 compact and the R50V, I guess V5V. Yeah. Anyway, mirrorless cameras, right? And what makes them a bit more vlogging friendly is their better video specs. So 4K at 60fps video, and then, you know, they're built for like easier live streaming. We'll start with the PowerShot V1. I mean, it was already announced and already available in Japan, but now it's coming to North America if anyone here has been, you know, eyeing it. And I think it's really interesting. It has a 1.4-inch 20.3 megapixel sensor, so that's quite big actually compared to the Sony ZV-1 Mark II, which has a 1-inch sensor. So 1.4 inch is like roughly the same size as Micro Four Thirds, according to Steve Dent from Engadget, but it has a horizontal aspect ratio that is better suited for video. So I think I remember like back in the day when I was like reviewing DSLRs and mirrorless cameras that like the 1.4 inch seemed more of a fantasy than anything else. But like to see it now in such a compact size is like quite wild to me. And Steve has been using it for a little bit too. He's got a bit of a hands-on, some impressions in this post. So if you want to take a look at his impressions of it, take a look on Engadget.com. There's also the second camera. The second one is the R50V/5, and again, similarly has like the creator-friendly video spec. So if you've been in the market, you're a Canon person like I am. I mean, I like Canon because I like the color treatment. I'm much more of like the slightly more rosy, I guess, hues versus a Nikon or Nikon. Then yeah, take a look. They seem like good options. I'm intrigued myself.
It feels like Sony has been kind of killing it with the smaller bloggy cameras, I guess, where at least they've like done a good job, and it's nice to have competition, like a slightly larger sensor. I was just looking up the DJI Osmo Pocket 3, which we also use, which is not, it's a handheld gimbal thing, but that has a one inch sensor. So it's kind of wild, like what we can fit into things now. And when we shoot with those things, like we shot at WWDC last year, Sherlyn, and we've done videos with it throughout the site, but people got me as like, why does that look so good? It kind of looks like you're holding your phone up, but it looks much better than your phone. And that's the value of having a slightly bigger sensor than what your phone does.
Yes.
Yeah.
You get that very nice depth of field. It's surprising with a one-inch sensor. I mean, the lens is also a huge thing. But speaking of the lens, people in the chat are asking, like, Declan is like, are the lenses are interchangeable? Can you use mirrorless lenses or are they smaller? I am not completely sure if you need to use a mount. I have to ask Steve, but we will follow up and let you know or read the article. Pretty sure it's in there once the page loads.
The vlogging camera looks like it's an all-in-one.
So yeah, the vlogging one, you mean?
The R50V is
And then Deeper Nine says they take SIM cards. Kind of cool. Wait, hang on a second. SIM cards? Are you talking SIM cards for a memory? What are we talking about here? That's not a spec I saw.
No, for like Wi-Fi, to get the data out there. Listen, that is a problem that needs to be solved because I'm right now, I just took some photos for my son's birthday. My son Alexander just turned 3, took some photos of my beautiful Sony A7C, which is a beautiful camera. The problem is getting those photos off. Like, I just want to get it to my phone to like text them to people. And it's like, you got to download the Sony app. You got to make sure it's secure wireless connection to the Sony app. It's a really stupid, annoying process. We need better ways to get that data off. So if a camera can automatically sync your stuff to like an online drive or something, that'd be nice. Remember the
my God,
iFi cards?
Don't.
The iFi SD card.
They were such a horror.
Yeah.
Those were the days. Like, I remember they were trying to fuss with them because it was so difficult to get any good Wi-Fi on any camera. I mean, back when I was, again, testing them, Fuji used to be the worst at Wi-Fi. I think Canon and Nikon were both like fine. Like they would pass, they would send over, but they would be slow, obviously. And then the iFi was arguably like the most MacGyver-y, like the most clunky sort of way to fix it.
You put like wireless Wi-Fi receiver in the SD card. So make the SD card a thing that has connectivity. I remember just nightmares with that thing. Like when I had an editor, I may have told this story before, but like it was like some big event. I think it was like Google I/O in the 2010s at some point. They brought a camera with the iFi card. And I was like, you got a cable to connect that, right? Because we need to transfer those photos. It's like, no, it's going to be fine. No, not at Moscone Center in San Francisco with like 1,000 laptops out. There's no way that iFi card is going to get anything out. And it failed. It completely failed. So fix this. Somebody fix
SIM
this.
SIM cards, though. Is that the way? I wonder if, especially since they're meant to be like for video, like sending it over cellular, which by the way, probably is not going to be 5G. Even if it's LTE, it won't be like that great. I don't know. We'll see.
They have not reduced 5G radios enough for that. But I don't know. Something UWB. Bigger, something better for that. You wanted to talk about some Apple stuff, Sherlyn, specifically. We know when WWDC is happening, June 9th and 13th. How do you feel about that?
I mean, that's entirely as we expected. And to be clear, these are the WWDC conference dates, so June 9th to 13th, so that week. And you can imagine the keynote is going to be sometime that week. We're going to probably learn a little bit about what's up in the next iOS, what's up in the next, all the different software they do. But I don't know if we have any big expectations on hardware, obviously. I know that people in the chat were asking, do you think AirTags 2 are coming? And I know that that's the big industry rumor. But like, you know, who knows what else they might show? I have no idea. I have no real clue. But I do want to point out that, yeah, go on.
The question is like, what the hell happened to your AI stuff? Because like this is going to be a really interesting WWDC because they pitched us Apple Intelligence. They pitched us Super Smart Siri last year. Then they had to walk that back.
And or delay,
through an official statement. Well, not through like, they had to walk that back by like backhanded commentary to John Gruber and news sites. Like really, like a really quiet way of saying we screwed up. I wonder how Apple's going to respond to that and what they're going to say. And are they going to be more careful about the demos they show us or what they say on the video, like on the announcement video versus what they actually demo to people? Kind of an interesting time. What new hardware? I don't know. What else can we expect at this point? Like the laptops are good. The AirTags are old, but those still work fine.
I mean, yeah. I don't mind. Like, I think the AirTags would be an interesting thing to release because a lot of, I mean, I buy them as gifts for people. You know, I think they're a pretty decent option.
Yeah.
And the ones that are available now work fine. I could see some improvements in terms of the, like, standard upgrade or whatever, but, or make them, I don't know, smaller, easier to carry around, make them like not battery rechargeable would be interesting. I don't know.
They have to be basically the size to accept those watch batteries. So that's kind of the constraint there. So, because those are, it's actually really easy to change batteries on those things. But I feel like you can't go smaller than that. Then how would you recharge it, right? Are they going to be like little things that you go on like the Apple Watch wireless charger to charge up? I don't know. That's certainly a possibility. There are also the rumors about the sort of like, the smart display, right, plus speaker thing that can, like, talk to you. But those rumors were also tied to the smarter Siri. Like, that was a smarter Siri-dependent device. So if you don't have the smarter Siri, that device is kind of dead in the water. So I don't know if they would even show that off until they're ready. I feel like Apple's a little scared at this point, but... yeah. Anything else you want to mention Apple-wise?
Yeah, so DubDub's not usually the place we expect. By the way, I say DubDub. We don't usually expect hardware. So yeah, if the AirTags happen, great. But we're more likely to see updates on the Apple Intelligence or Siri side. And then we did see some hardware-ish announcements this week, courtesy of the AirPods Max, which Apple announced on Monday that we'll be getting an update to support lossless audio. The USB-C version of the AirPods Max will get lossless audio support. They won't be available until like iOS 18.4 rolls out, which is expected sometime, I think, maybe next month in April. And also in ultra low latency audio is also coming with that update. And they will be available for the USB-C model only because it is happening through wired mode, if I'm not wrong. So, yeah.
Not wireless, lossless. How are you feeling? How are you feeling about the AirPods Max?
I see them around.
Because I'm like, it's been around for so long. I see them around. I see people with them. Like, I don't need another pair of headphones. I understand how stupid it is. I wish the price had come down more below $400. Because I'm like, I kind of do like the sort of seamless transition I get between Apple devices with AirPods. Having those things would be kind of nice. I don't know. Like, I know people who have them who really like them. I also know the downsides. Like, I think the Sonys can get to higher resolution audio because they're not limited as Apple.
I don't think the AirPods Max is something you buy if you care about, like, high quality, high fidelity audio. You buy it as a status symbol. And that's why the market is people who are at the gym with their AirPods around their thighs. Like, I think that's the people who go and buy this thing.
There are people at the gym with the AirPods Max? Seriously?
It's like, it's been a thing.
That is,
So.
Around their thigh?
Devinder, just be glad you're not in the social media circles that I'm in. Because they're not
around
great.
Their thigh?
Yeah. If you want to check out a subreddit full of these, I will send you a link. Anyway, some people in our chat are clearly quite excited about this. A dude named Charlie says, I am overly excited about lossless audio, but dude named Charlie says wireless.
All right.
And Mark Dow does point out that, like, at least Apple Music does have a lot of lossless music in its catalog. So I think this is a good thing. But yeah, this was like a small iterative, like, little piece of news that, you know, is not new hardware, obviously. I will say, I think that at DubDub, you know, people again in the chat have mentioned that there are rumors of a major iOS redesign. And I have seen those rumors. I don't know if you have, Devendra, but they're trying to align. Yeah, the look of iOS 19 supposedly is supposed to mirror that of the visual interface in the Vision Pro, which means the icons will no longer be super squircly, but actually full circles, perhaps. And we... Nate, our deputy editor of news, was actually wrote a piece last week or the week before about how Apple should be focusing on fixing Siri, not redesigning iOS. And I think, having read that, I agree with his take. We'll see.
I had a conversation with Nate because it's sort of like I think that's a very valid position to take. I also think Apple is a freaking giant company that can do two things at one time. Like, you got to fix a smarter Siri, but the team fixing that is not the team working on iOS software. Is it like there are whole different like workloads happening here? And I have to say, there is something nice about a refresh.
Yeah,
there is something
visually,
nice about taking a step back, looking at your aesthetic visually. It's a cheap way to sell more devices to you because you're like, oh man, if my to have a new phone with a bigger screen or something, like that would be nice with this new interface. But also, I think aesthetically, there's always room for improvement. Like iOS is functional, but it's slowly just become more like Android, right? They've taken over widgets, lock screen stuff. They've become more Android, but there's no like Apple. So, like, what is Apple actually bringing to the table beyond like the
basic framework? I will tell you, I could talk about these like little design changes to Android versus iOS forever. And I will say that like we have observed over the last, I want to say 2 to 3 years, that Apple seems more, not only just more open to the idea, but like they seem to care way more about wanting to make iOS more customizable, which they haven't done in a long time. But it started, I think, with like focus modes, honestly. I think that was iOS 16. And then, yeah, then came the wallpaper, then came widgets, and then came this like freedom from the grid on your home screen. So there's more on that. I think we will see it dubbed up. And then I think Mark Dell said, "We're getting full circles. How do I get on the beta?" Which like, that's quite funny. I'm sorry.
Full circles, baby.
I mean, that headline writes itself. But yes, Ben.
I bet what happened at Apple was that they started planning a big iOS refresh several years ago. Then all of this generative AI stuff came up and they were like, oh crap, we have to get on that wave. Skirt, let's like work in that direction. Then they're like, the big iOS like refresh needs to include like LLM, generative AI, like smarter Siri. So let's just make sure that that works. Now it doesn't work. And that has just blown up all of the timelines across the entire company.
That's what a lot of people are saying. And that's why, yeah, it's going to be that whatever that smart display thing will be, like that's delayed because we're waiting for the smarter Siri and everything. Again, I'm not as annoyed at Apple about waiting on those AI features. I am annoyed that they showed it off as a thing that could actually happen within the next year. That's annoying. That's a bit of false advertising there. But also, you guys got to get these features right. Microsoft, Google, everybody. Like these companies have been so blasé about how they implement AI and like how they just throw it into the user experience and expect us to deal with it. I'm not a fan of that. And I think like Apple, at the very least, what do they do well is like really think about user experience.
Yeah.
If that's not up to snuff, then
it's like what they do with the Vision Pro, right? Like they waited almost arguably a little too long. And then they came up with a thing that was so much better than like any other VR headset.
But everybody thinks it failed.
Well, I think that's not right. I don't think that's a fault of Apple and more the fault of the industry assuming that VR was going to take off the way they thought it would. It just wasn't going to. But I wanted to point out that like the thing I remembered I was going to say is that D-Man in the chat says, are Apple's displays due for an update? Maybe not this year, but some future horizon time. I don't know if Devendra, you have any thoughts on like display technology on the iPhones or...
They don't update their displays that often, but I reviewed, was it the studio display and the thing that was like $1,500? That thing is still 60 hertz, damn it. Like give us more refresh rate. Like you can do more.
I know. Some, but
120.
Like, I mean,
give us 120, because like the leap between 60 and 120 alone is good.
Well,
but yeah.
What was it we were just talking about? Oh yeah. And so Ben, when you were talking about the potentially rushed into this, I also just jogged my memory of, we saw last week the Wired report on inside Google's rush, right, to put out its Gemini AI stuff. And clearly companies, like you said, like Microsoft, like Google have been rushing into this, and we've hoped for Apple to stop, but maybe there was some other kind of pressure, and I don't know where that pressure is coming from for them, but they felt it somehow and decided to rush into it. It's very unlike Apple. And yeah, I just wanted to bring up the Google story because we didn't really get around to talking about it. And I'm also very jealous that they published this story. Oh yeah, I'm like jealous because I feel as if I could have reported that story. But anyway, hey, if you work at Google, you want to give me tips, send them to me. They're just like, we'll talk off record. We'll be friends on Signal.
I think you got to use Signal for that, Shirlin. Use Signal, but be careful.
Exactly. We will be friends on Signal. I know how to add people on Signal now because I read that handy little guide.
And not accidentally add anybody else?
Exactly.
We don't know. I mean, you have a lot of friends, Shirlin. Like, that's the thing. You want to be a Signal chat with a source, and then
they'll scoop my story like they did at Wired.
No, I'm kidding. Oh, man. Shout out to Wired, who, by the way, who is doing great work in like a time of peril, but also they just published a fun story about like RISC-V, the like chip, you know, ISA architecture thing. Like the fact that they can still juggle that, that's a really fun story about RISC-V.
Oh, yeah. The headline was like Angelina Jolie was right all along.
She was right.
Because she mentioned it. Her character in Hackers mentioned it like 25 years ago, 30 years ago.
The nerds in the 90s, like the CISC versus RISC whole thing, like that was a major thing going on. It was also fun to read this because I'm like thinking about how to review CPUs right now, and that actually ties a lot into it. But anyway.
Last two things I will say. One is that, like, again, Mark Dell in the chat is like, just accidentally add Shirley into your Signal group chat. Yes, I welcome it all. I'll put my Signal out there so that y'all can accidentally add me to your internal Google PR chats. The second thing I will say is that last piece of Apple news this week, that it seems like the company may have avoided that fine that the EU wanted it to be fined. This was the executive arm of the European Commission that has been probing into whether Apple hindered iPhone users from easily changing their browser search engine. They were about to be dealt a fine, but it seems like, according to a post by Reuters, that Apple may have complied with rules laid out under the DMA Digital Markets Act. And therefore may be avoiding a fine. So the reason I want to like just stuff it in there at the very bottom is because it still seems like very may and may not. It's not confirmed, it seems. But it is relevant to like what Apple has been doing this week in the news as well.
Also, we wanted to talk about something that I think we're all a little surprised by. The news hit this week that Napster, remember Napster, sold for $207 million to Infinite Reality. That company plans to use it for like creating virtual 3D spaces for music fans to attend concerts and listening parties and stuff. That's a lot of money for Napster in the year 2025, don't you think?
I mean, look, yes, it's a lot of money. B, it also doesn't seem as much as like the big tech companies are like getting valued at right now, right? Like all the AI companies are in the billions. So like, grand scheme, $207 million.
I mean, that is a busted reality. Like, I don't even want to talk
about
it.
I agree. It's dystopian.
It's dystopian. The guy who left OpenAI was like, I don't got a useless idea for, I got AGI coming.
Yeah, Ilya Sutskever got something like $2 billion. And he's like, I'm not releasing anything until we have super intelligence.
I'm not.
So,
yes.
What is he going to be doing?
Give me.
Living on yachts.
I also.
Like,
live on a yacht. Listen, whoever is listening, I also will not release AGI until you give me $1 billion. Even cheaper.
Yeah, I think Ben and I were laughing at the same comment in the chat, which is how much is Kaza worth now?
Yep.
I'm thinking 100K, if that. So here, can I point out, though, I believe the Napster sale, because I was preparing the social post for this, the Napster sale is not just for the brand name and the logo, which I think Mark was asking, is that what the money was for? I think it's for the platform to build into this, like the company that bought it, it's called Infinite Reality, and the CEO has come out and said something like, we're looking to build this immersive experience thing that's powered by like these music interactive experiences that like feels like it ties a little bit more in to the whole Napster like pitch, right? Like what was Napster
like,
used for initially?
What proprietary technology does Napster have now that isn't completely obsolete?
It's old brand stuff.
Which is why hats off to the writer of our post who said it sounds like using 1999 technology in a platform that arguably peaked in 2021 is the whole basis of the sale, which is just great.
One bit from the story, Napster holds numerous licenses to stream millions of songs, which is what made it an attractive prospect for Infinite Reality. So that could be it. But that's a license to stream music. You don't own the music. That license will expire and you have to pay for it again. So I don't, again.
It might just be a really good deal. They're like, it's better to spend $207 million than to spend much more money today's day and age for Warner exclusive, like Warner's rights or whatever. Like, I don't know what it is.
It's true. But that's a license to use those rights. It's not like you don't have exclusive access to those rights because other streaming companies do. It's sort of like what you're talking about, Trillin, putting your AirPods Max on your hip. This company's
your
like,
thigh, bro. Now your hip.
Napster. Wait, what?
Your
what
thigh. Is... Imagine the headphones, you wrap them around your thigh.
Thigh, hip. It's all connected. It's all kind of right there. Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about what's happening around Engadget. Igor has a review of the Nothing Phone 3A and 3A Pro. Tell us more about it.
They're clear. That seems nice.
I love the look of these things. We talked about them on the show when they were announced. I think they were an MWC launch. And I like the headline of like rising above the boring competition. I think they look different. They look good. I think they also I like that they don't make AI their whole deal. Cameras seem good for the price, especially it's like $499. It's available in North America or like
$349 and $459.
So right, sorry, $459. I got the two numbers crossed. So $459 actually, is the pro model.
$459. Yeah.
Right.
Let me actually look up the other one because I see multiple prices being talked about here. Igor was talking about the Nothing 3 as well.
So the Nothing 3A and 3A Pro, right? The 4 something 9 is the Pro model.
I see $379 and $459 basically.
Yeah. I really focused my attention on the Pro model because that's the one that comes closest in price range to the the Pixel 9a that was announced like last week, March 19th, I believe. Yeah, 2 weeks ago. And it looks great. Like not only for the price, it looks great. It just looks different. Every other phone right now, the Galaxy, the Pixel, they all start to look like iPhones, even, you know, and it's just kind of sad we don't have a phone that has such character anymore. So I'm happy for Nothing for doing this.
Yeah,
nice of character.
Can we officially declare Nothing as like at least the most interesting looking?
Yeah, I think interesting looking
maker in the
phone.
U.S.
Yes.
Because like there are very interesting phones that aren't available in the U.S. OnePlus has some pretty interesting looking things that you're never going to get unless you go to the U.K. and buy it at a cell phone store there.
Some of them. Not all of them.
Yeah, not all. Some of them are still available here, maybe like in limited supply or like if you know the side channels or something. But yeah, we know that a lot of overseas phone makers that are not selling in the U.S. tend to be more interesting and experimental and innovative in terms of their design or form factor. But like, this is just not what people buy, I guess. It's kind of strange.
It's kind of also I'm looking at the Pro, like they're sort of like Apple-esque summary of all their features. It's kind of wild. 50 megapixel front camera?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you say Apple-esque, you mean their website, right? Like the Nothing website?
I mean their website, they have like a compilation of the stuff. But designed in London is one of the highlights of their feature set.
While we're talking about Nothing, I do want to mention Matt Smith's story about Nothing's Essential Spaces app. He says that it's an AI-powered app done right. Really want to be able to talk to him sometime in the next few weeks about this because there's been so many cases where AI has been crammed into things where it shouldn't otherwise be. So I want to hear more about something that actually does it right.
Definitely.
To add to
also,
that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Really quickly, last word on that. Matt also mentioned that in his hands-on with the Nothing phone when they were launched, I think around MWC time, which would be like early March and February. And then, yeah, Igor also points out pretty much the same. So I think that it's valuable that two different people who have experienced the phone came to a similar conclusion of like this Nothing Essentials space, while kind of rudimentary right now, seems like a thoughtful implementation that has potential. So that is definitely like cool. Dev, you were saying.
Do the Nothing phones, by the way, do they have full access to the Google apps?
Yeah, they are like properly always Android devices, yes.
Properly Android. That's always been like an issue with some of these things. That's cool. These look very good, especially for the price. Like we were like, oh my God, who is it made a $499? The Pixel phone,
Pixel
the latest
9A.
One is $499. Yeah. And then this is like, this actually looks even better for slightly less. And then iPhone 16e. What are you doing?
Yeah, I know.
What are you, for what?
Yeah. There's also the Galaxy A56, by the way, which will also retail for $499, but that's if and when it shows up here in the U.S.
Yep, that's something. All right, thank you for that review. Also, Mr. Jeff Dunn reviewed the plain iPad, the latest 2025 iPad with A16. No Apple intelligence, no problem, he said, which is basically what we said on the podcast, right?
Yeah, it's our theme. Can I just ask, going to take an unofficial like focus group or poll here. If you're listening, if you're watching, tell me, send an email to podcast@gadget.com, leave a comment here on the YouTube, whatever. What would you have called this iPad? Like, how are you differentiating between iPads, the base iPads? Because I was like, what should we put in the headline? Is it the iPad with A16?
It's just here.
Is it the iPad 2025? Is it the iPad 11? Because that's what I see some other like sites call it. So y'all tell
nobody
me.
Nobody calls it iPad 11.
Apparently
on the box,
people do.
It says, on the box, it says iPad. And
right,
it's the
exactly.
iPad
that's
Divine
the thing.
2025.
Apple doesn't make
this
easy for us. So we have to figure out our own way to label different generations from different generations. So anyway, I have my sense for what people call it, but I'd like to hear. what other people think.
Year plus chip, and the chip is actually a good designing and a good SEO bit too, I guess, for us. But those are the demarcations of what makes this one new and fresh. I remember.
Noah Squire says 11. D-Man says 11. Markdell says they go by the year.
Doesn't.
The new iPad.
Nobody does 11. Remember, I think
what
it was an iPad.
iPad Classic?
No. No, let's not even. Okay. Let's just iPad.
Keep going.
It's clean. It's clean. But I think after the first iPad, they were going with like numbers for a while. I think it was around the 4 where they went back to just iPad. Something around there. And I had a couple sources back then who would tell me things about what was happening in Apple. And people were like, it's going to be called iPad 4. And I wrote a story saying it's going to be called iPad 4. Internally, it was called iPad 4. Externally, they marketed it as iPad. So there,
oh,
two
no,
things
can
be
true. Face. Ish,
two
I
things
guess?
Can be
Not
true.
Not really your fault.
Yeah, ish. Not. I mean, that's just what happens. That's why you try to get multiple sources.
Exactly.
To,
corroborate
to
a story.
Say things.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it works. But anyway. That was a fun time. I think the year makes the most sense. Like, that's in terms of what you're buying, right? Nobody, if you in a couple of years are like, iPad A16, iPad 11, when did this come out? How does this compare to what is here many years down the line? The year kind of makes the most sense there. Yeah. Anything you want to mention that you've been working on, Trillin?
This is always a good question for me. My role is such that, like, what I'm working on is not something I can typically plan out anymore, other than, like, the general organization of, like, how we cover things. And, like, my job's so much reactive now, right? It's like, what dev is working on becomes, like, it funnels its way to me. And then, so I think you can see some more reviews on our site soon. I'm very excited for some of them coming up. There's a Nintendo event going on as we record this podcast, which I'm interested to see.
The game
see.
Event, not the Switch 2 event. Yeah.
Yes. A Switch 2 less Nintendo event is, I think, how we wrote about it. So no hardware, but like game things, game trailers, that sort of stuff. And then planning out the month of April, which is, y'all will see, is going to be surprisingly packed. It's just, okay. That's
it's
me.
Be super, super packed. I can mention a couple of things. I'm finishing up my review of that Ryzen chip, the 9950X 3D. If you want a primer on AMD's V-cache, 3D V-cache technology and why it's good for chips, I think it's going to be a good read. But also, there's stuff happening. There's media coming up. I'm going to work on a review of the new Shinichiro Watanabe show, the creator of Cowboy Bebop, reviewing Lazarus, I believe, next week. I got to double-check that timing. Lazarus is his new show coming to Adult Swim, in early April. And also, the Minecraft movie's happening, folks. And, I'm gonna have some thoughts on the Minecraft movie. Maybe we'll have some fun with that one. But I have very little hope that it'll be good. But it is intriguing.
That's what I'm hearing.
Jared Hess.
That's what I'm hearing.
Jared Hess, the director of Napoleon Dynamite, is doing that movie. So
I saw that movie, Napoleon Dynamite. I mean, we talked about it. Like,
it was a thing. It was a big deal for a long time.
I know. I think people were excited for it. I was too.
You were excited for it. It was just a weird slice of culture that we were living in.
Can I just point out, Dev, that Declan in the chat says you got added. Devendra got added to the wrong iPad 4 Signal chat.
Oh no, I did. I did actually. That's what happened. While we're talking about Jared Hess, has anybody seen Nacho Libre? You remember that movie?
Oh yeah, Mark just said Jack Black everywhere. So yeah, I guess Nacho Libre.
That movie was great. I actually remember liking that movie a lot. It's co-written by Mike White, who has gone on to great acclaim.
Oh, we love Mike White
for White Lotus. But that is a sweet movie about a Lucha Libre wrestler who's also a priest. And I don't know. I like Jared Hess. I like Napoleon Dynamite, even though it got all overplayed. So we're gonna have some fun, media reviews coming soon. Got any pop culture picks for us this week, Shalyn?
Yes. I'm just going through my list of ideas that I usually recommend. But anyway, so this is not so much a pick as a quasi review. I saw The Gorge on Apple TV Plus. It's that science fiction rom-commy thing that stars Anya Taylor-Joy and Miles Teller. I don't know. It's just a very strange genre for me. I was like, wait, are they falling in love in what's supposed to be a very serious movie? And like, why are they making it feel like it was just such a genre mix up? And I did not enjoy some of the accents. I will not say what or who. Y'all just watch it. But I did. I did think it was interesting enough in that it kind of makes you pay attention because it's so weird. You know, it's like, huh. Premise is interesting. Premise of the story. Premise of the genre of the film itself is interesting. So anyway, I watched it on Apple TV Plus. I thought I like when Apple TV gets into science fiction films, that sort of thing. So yeah,
science fiction's that big budget stuff too. That's I like the director. It's the guy who did Doctor Strange and a whole bunch of stuff. I've liked his horror films, and also the producer and writers on those. Those are films I generally like. I want to quickly shout out two things which are not doing so well in theaters, and it's a damn shame. Steven Soderbergh's Black Bag, which is a spy, really cool, sexy, stylish spy movie. Sherlyn, I think you should see this in the theater because it's beautiful people doing cool spy stuff. There's computer stuff. There's data. There's intrigue. The people are very beautiful. That's the other thing. The people are beautiful. The clothes are beautiful. Michael Fassbender, Cate Blanchett, Pierce Brosnan's in here. Reggae Jean Page is in here. Marissa Abella, an actress who I really like in Industry, a show you should be watching, Sherlyn, because I think you'd be down with it. Naomi Harris. Like, it is... it's stacked. It's also really well written, really fun, like just a really smart thing. It's almost like if a spy movie were kind of like a murder mystery at the same time. And the basic pitch is, what if a spy guy were also a wife guy?
Oh, no, wait. I cannot deal with that guy. Term this year.
If Cate Blanchett was your wife, would you be the ultimate, you know, wife partner?
I'll do anything
you ask. Yeah. Cate Blanchett. So that's basically the pitch of the movie, and I think it's a lot of fun. Less fun, but also is out in theaters and people may be into it, is Novocaine, the Jack Quaid movie where he cannot feel pain. He has to go rescue a girl who likes him, sort of. This thing was well reviewed. I think it's perfectly fun and fine. I've got a lot of issues with the sort of like internal logic of this movie. But Jack Quaid is doing his shtick. His character is kind of a reverse Wolverine where he cannot feel pain, but he can experience all the pain. Like, he can still be hurt, but he doesn't feel the pain. Whereas Wolverine feels the hurt, but it doesn't really... He ultimately heals from everything.
Yeah.
He heals. This guy doesn't heal. And they kind of use that in fun ways. Like, there are action scenes here where he just has to do crazy things to him, to his body and his self. There's a lot of body horror in here. But it's kind of a fun time. Certainly, like, different. There's a different kind of take of how you do an action movie. I don't think it holds up. I think it's a perfectly fine action romp. If you need to pick one movie that's still in theaters or will probably be on video on demand soon, it's Black Bag. Like, I cannot wait to own that movie and rewatch it. Rewatch at home many, many times. Soderbergh is just on a roll, too, between this and present. So, anyway, if you want to shout those out, check them out, folks.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
Where can you find me? At Devendra on Twitter, Blue Sky. Did I say Black Flag or Black Bag?
I think you said both.
No,
and
you
I'm
said Black
confused.
Bag.
I said Black Bag. Okay.
No, I think you I said Black Bag the entire time.
Okay.
It's just that one person was like, oh, isn't that the Ubisoft game?
Yeah,
no, that's
yeah.
Assassin's Creed.
Okay.
Black Flag.
I was correct. All right. Black
Bag. Is it Black
at Bag? At Devendra, everywhere.
It's Black
yeah,
Bag.
Yeah, Black Bag is okay. The movie. Like, it's the sort of, like, spy thing. Also, talk about movies, if you can imagine, at the Filmcast, at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me, yeah, your favorite generation names for an iPad, I guess, you can send them to me either via email, podcast@engadget, Sherlyn@engadget, whichever you prefer, or, I guess, bsky, you know, bluesky, CHERLYNN.bsky.social. Email us your thoughts about the show at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review wherever you're tuning in. And then, yeah, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform or all of them.